history, the economy has been dominated by scarcity. A man in his lifetime saw some good seasons with large schools of fish, abundant native grains and fruits, and large quantities of edible migrating animals. Good seasons were the exception rather than the rule. Even 500 years ago, most of the world's economic activity was concerned with the supply of the basic necessities of life. The focus was on hunting and gathering for survival. Through agriculture and the domestication of animals, scarcity gradually gave way to relative adequacy. By comparison, today's economy is one of almost unbelievable abundance. Let's now consider a hypothetical scenario based on the potential that is known to exist in current technology. The efficient application of this technology is likely to create an abundance never before dreamed of. If this comes about, it will bring with it not only new problems, but radically different thought patterns. This hypothesis also helps us to understand some of the problems of our present economies. Economic activity consists of the application of existent energy supplies to matter in order to change it into a more usable form. We know that matter and energy are interchangeable and that they are actually the same thing in different forms. Access to this energy on a costless or near costless basis must be the foundation of any future superabundant economy. I am given to understand that there is enough energy in a bucket of water to run a nation like the United States of America for a long period. Should we ever access this energy in a near costless form, everything would change. By costless, I mean that a minimum of human energy will be applied to the extraction of this energy. Theories of men like Nikola Tesla and scientific experiments in fusion encourage us to believe that this hypothesis could soon become a reality. The amount of human effort required to meet the demands placed on the production system will be drastically reduced. This will have enormous consequences on the labour market. We will need new ways to apply this energy to reach maximum efficiency. Imagine a machine which could separate each of the elements in any kind of material from all of the other elements. Some elements in their purest form could be turned into what we know as supermetals, which are relatively indestructible. It is said, for instance, that a family car travelling at 60 miles per hour could not break a piano wire made from one of these supermetals. Such metals have already been used in space exploration. Several years ago, some debris from a satellite was found in rural Australia. The hollow metal sphere, about 2 feet across with a small aperture, was extremely light for its size. Though they belted it with large steel sledgehammers, they were unable to dent or mark it in any way. The application of abundant, costless energy to such materials would completely revolutionise our economy. A home capable of lasting 1,000 years, at least 100 times stronger than present structures, might only weigh a ton or two and be conveyed on one truck to your home site. Such homes might be supplied at very little cost, as the energy available for their manufacture would be so abundant. Under these circumstances, it would be difficult to build in obsolescence, as is the current habit. Home building might only be a matter of informing a computer of your requirements and waiting a week before taking delivery of the prefabricated result. An afternoon might be spent with your friends assembling and securing this large, extremely light structure and settling down in the sure and certain knowledge that the structure was guaranteed for 1,000 years. Such technology would cause a complete restructuring in the mining industry. The extraction of pure uranium from the earth would be accomplished far more efficiently than is currently the case. However, in this economy, uranium would probably be just a useless byproduct. We could also expect an unlimited supply of the relatively common elements. The price of gold would probably fall to the point where it could compete with ceramic tiles as a lining for bathrooms. A motor car made of supermetals would last for generations. It may be powered by hydrogen, now that the previously expensive elements needed for the safe storage of hydrogen were abundantly available and inexpensive. The burning of hydrogen gas produced from water would become environmentally neutral, since nothing but water would be emitted from the vehicle. I don't have time to draw many of the extraordinary pictures and concepts that might flow from such technological possibilities. However, shelter and transport would consume almost insignificant amounts of human energy compared to present-day demands. Man would still have to feed himself, but in doing this, he would have available enormous energy and the very best in machinery. There would be plenty of energy to desalinate the seas and to deliver fresh water in abundant quantities to any point on Earth. Properly irrigated and farmed, the Sahara could support the world's current population. Aquaculture currently remains almost unexplored, although already farming from fresh water is able to commercially produce more protein per acre than any other form of production. We shall persist with this speculation a little longer in order to demonstrate potential problems associated with superabundance. These problems are also relevant to today's economy. This new technology might be developed in a relatively short period of time. Can you imagine the enormous activity worldwide that would follow the drafting of a plan to supply such an abundance for every human being on the face of the earth? Almost every human resource could be mustered to build this super plant of the future. Those who were not directly involved in building the machinery for production would be involved in sustaining those that were. To establish this plant, governments might borrow from their own banking systems additional money to cover any national debts then current. The collateral for these loans would be the abundance soon to be produced. The world would have a rich, active, fully employed economy, even through the period of construction. Imagine what it would be like when the capital plant was all fully constructed and the abundance began to flow. The whole world might be fully housed in the housing of their choice in a very short time. Each family could have a form of conveyance to last for generations. Food production, aided by this low-cost energy and material, could increase immeasurably. Every current shortage worldwide, and there aren't even too many today, might be supplied to embarrassing superabundance. It has been suggested that such abundance would only require the attention of about 2% of the world's population, and would allow all of those not involved to pursue creative endeavours in the arts, the sciences, or their own special interests on a full-time basis. What a world! What an abundance where there is a greater realisation of human potential and higher purposes. What will happen to the 98% of the population who have been educated for employment in an economy that only requires 2% for it to be completely efficient? Presumably close to all of the world's population would apply for positions on the permanent maintenance staff. The competition would be fierce, and given a free market, the salaries offered would certainly not need to be grand. A fortnight later, what would the human condition be a fortnight after the release of such abundance? The 98% of the population who had not been able to secure employment and income from the new technology and who did not have any savings to draw on, would at this point realise that they would soon die of starvation. The companies that owned these tremendous productive units would soon realise that they would shortly have to follow because of the debt they had incurred. Repayments would be substantial because of the compound interest involved during the setup period. Now, if the unemployed 98% could survive long enough to visit the showrooms in their indestructible cars, they would have no income with which to buy the superabundant, long-life products to furnish their sledgehammer-proof houses. Perhaps the government can help. But the government would still have to meet its high national debt, as well as the social security payments to the unemployed 98%. To do this, it could perhaps tax the 2% who are employed to the extent of all of their wages, causing them to line up for social welfare payments. Governments would have no choice but to seize all remaining bank deposits in order to ensure that all the people lived at least a little longer. Once all savings and taxes had been received by the owners of the technology in payment for the goods they were able to sell, the banks would foreclose on them for the outstanding balance. There is little doubt that this generation would crave for the good old days when houses required maintenance men, cars rusted, stockings laddered, and bananas occasionally went out of season. But how do you go back to the old technology when there is already a superabundance of every product at such a low cost? The common practice is for all individuals to go bankrupt, and for the government itself, once it has confiscated all the people's money, to go bankrupt. The companies who produce all this superabundance would also go bankrupt because there'd be no market to sell to. At this point, we would be forced into the most primitive means of survival. That is, if we could overcome the fact that our education would not have equipped us for such a lifestyle. It should be clear by now that while the legitimate object of all economic advancement is abundant production for human needs at the ever-decreasing cost in terms of human labour and resources, this is ultimately impossible unless we are prepared to amend our thinking about finance to suit the changed circumstance. The more efficient the production system becomes, the less human labour is required, and therefore less money is made available for consumers by way of wages. Obviously, there will be less and less money available for consumers to spend on the goods produced, and therefore the producers will not be able to meet their compounding debt repayments. Thus, the economy is bound for destruction unless we can properly democratise and distribute funds outside of the employment system. We will no doubt never reach the hypothetical end of economic effort as described. However, as we progress towards this low-cost superabundance, increasing historic debt and the inability to meet that debt will mean that access to that abundance through employment will become increasingly difficult. At the top of this chart is the banking system, which creates the nation's money and lends that money to industry. Industry then sets about commanding the resources of society in order to construct and operate enterprises to produce goods and services. On the left of the chart, you will see that one of the functions of industry has been the distribution of wages, salaries, bonuses, and dividends. These payments are made to consumers who can then take them to the marketplace in order to make their purchases. On the other side of the chart, industry produces goods and sometimes services with prices. The prices of these goods comprise all wages, salaries, and dividends, which we have termed A1. Also included in prices are all of those payments which go towards meeting historical debt and other charges. The costs that we call B1, going into the price of goods, include all payments to non-consumers. Payments for raw materials, payments for bank charges, payments for depreciation, provision for reserves, bad debts, and all other payments which are not made directly to consumers. Thus we can see that in the marketplace, if other factors are not involved at all, the consumer's purchasing power on the left would be insufficient to meet the total prices on the right. This is not to say that the B1 payments were not payments to consumers at some previous time. Indeed, they were. The easiest way to explain what we are saying is by way of example. Take a very simple, familiar item like a ceramic coffee mug and have a look at the components of its $1 price tag. If the manufacturer's books were inspected in order to ascertain the various elements comprising that cost, we would likely see something like the following. 30 cents for materials, 20 cents labour, 15 cents rent on the building, 20 cents bad debts and depreciation, 15 cents for profit. If we examine the cost of rental of premises, we might discover that half of this rental cost of 15 cents per coffee mug may be going to liquidate debt incurred 5 years previously in the construction of the premises. Of that 7.5 cents, perhaps 3 cents was provisioned for liquidating historical costs incurred, say, 6, 8, 10 or more years previously. These loans were taken for plant, machinery and infrastructures required for the production of the consumer items in question. A breakdown of the 3 cents would lead back further still to other compounded costs. An investigation into the costs accounted into the $1 coffee mug would probably take us back some hundreds of years to the birth of the debt system we have inherited from banking systems. In a comparatively free market, every cent that the mug costs you may be, and probably is, a perfectly legitimate charge. It should be understood that in many businesses, production is maintained in the short term by failing to add depreciation charges. However, the long-term decline of that company's position is assured unless they can achieve a significant degree of catch-up in profit-taking. This chart shows that the wages and salaries that go into manufacturing the mug amount to 20 cents. If we presume that the dividend on the manufacturing of the cup had already been paid, which of course it hasn't, it would seldom amount to more than, say, 5 cents in the dollar. So we have total A payments to consumers of 25 cents, trying to liquidate legitimate costs to industry of $1. In that sort of proportion, unless other factors were brought to bear, 75% of all production would remain unsold. In this limited situation, the payments to consumers which induce them to produce consumer goods today will be much less than the prices of the goods produced. Therefore, the purchasing power in the market is insufficient to liquidate industry costs in producing consumer goods. The key thing to remember here is that we are discussing a fixed period of time. No matter what period we take, the fact is that payments to consumers are substantially less than the legitimate minimum price of those goods. This is because in the modern production system, a great deal of capital and compounded historic debt is involved. In a previous segment, we discussed the fact that wages, salaries, and dividends paid by car manufacturers only now amount to a maximum of 20% of the car price. Obviously, this does not reflect the overall situation because very little product at all would be being sold, and massive recession and industrial dislocation way beyond present levels would be painfully apparent. So let us look at one of the major historic factors which has helped to balance the situation in the current consumer market. While prices of consumer goods are comprised of all costs incurred in their production, that is, as we saw in the previous chart, A1 plus B1, there is another category of production, that of capital goods, which industry does not charge into consumer prices today, but it certainly does tomorrow. However, today or this week, the wages and salaries and other payments to consumers that are made in order to induce them to produce capital goods like tools and factories and tractors do go to the marketplace as purchasing power today. Therefore, the previous imbalance of A1 being less than A1 plus B1 is now a less knowable situation, where A1 plus A2 is at least closer to balancing A1 plus B1. This is one of the great dilemmas of the Western world. While the production of more machinery and more factories and more of everything of a capital nature continues at a high level, the economy can operate relatively satisfactorily. Historically, however, with increasing capital intensity, the price of, say, a tomato is now in part the depreciation of a 6-year-old tractor and a 10-year-old shed in which to house it. It is not purely comprised of manual labour with a hoe and a bucket with which to water the tomato plant. Thus, the gap between the A payments and the legitimate prices of consumer goods is continually widened. The greater part of the costs of producing a crop of tomatoes now is comprised of the depreciation and other capital costs associated with irrigation, tractors, spraying equipment, research costs for developing better plant strains, and grading and packing and transport machinery, and so on. He produces perhaps $50,000 worth of tomatoes for a $5,000 profit after a wage bill of less than $10,000. As we employ better industrial and capital aids in production, we increase the imbalance of the first chart. The major way in which this is compensated against is by keeping industrial expansion running at a faster and faster rate in order to overcome it with A2 payments. If ever we should arrive at the day where we have practically everything we need to provide practically everything we want, then we are not going to be able to afford to buy that which we can then so readily produce. Chart 2 shows the following situation. The prices in today's consumer market include A1 and B1. The purchasing power in today's consumer market consists of A1 plus A2, which is the payments to consumers for the production of capital goods. Therefore, at the bottom of chart 3, we can see whether A1 plus A2 is smaller than, greater than, or equal to A1 plus B1. Therefore, whether we are in boom or recession depends on whether the wages and salaries paid to produce capital goods, A2, is greater than or less than the capital costs of producing consumer goods, B1. A2 is less than B1 in all advanced economies at most times. Japan and West Germany suffered enough destruction in the Second World War to create enormous need for capital goods. Homes and factories had to be reconstructed. We can see that destruction may provide times when economies are in balance in this way. However, the norm is that they are not in balance. Built-in obsolescence has ensured a degree of ongoing production, but consumer resistance has thankfully limited this wasteful practice. Therefore, if there is not to be a permanent depression, other factors need to be considered. In recognition of the difficulty in overcoming this shortage of purchasing power, both the market and the government have responded in their respective ways. Banking systems over the last 20 years have funded an enormous increase in consumer debt. They have promoted debt facilities such as hire purchase, lease and time payment facilities. In its initial growth, this added to purchasing power and the A2 side, while not adding anything to the other side of the equation. But as soon as repayments have to be made, then you must add the increases in consumer debt to A2, and you must subtract debt repayments. Unless the expansion in consumer credit is greater than the interest payments, the net result is that consumer purchasing power is now actually reduced. In other words, the short-term aid offered by these forms of credit becomes a long-term exacerbation of the problem. Governments have accepted their responsibility to try to overcome this disequilibrium in the marketplace, which may be defined as insufficient purchasing power. All Western governments have, since World War II, vastly expanded government deficits. In other words, they have increased government debt. Where these deficits were used to fund higher employment and therefore greater payments to consumers, or payments to consumers in other ways, such as social securities, then this did for a time assist equilibrium. However, since governments only have access to borrowings, in a world in which it is the banks which create all the money and fund most of the deficits, then once the repayments of the deficit has to take place, with interest charges as well, consumer purchasing power is further reduced in the long term. The percentage of the government deficit spent in payments to consumers will add to consumers' purchasing power. However, on the other side of the scales, we must subtract the increased taxes which are occasioned by repaying yesterday's deficits plus the interest due. In blunt terms, increased debt is simply no answer. It is the historic problem. It can contribute nothing to consumer purchasing power without compounding the problem. Another attempt at a solution to this disequilibrium is what we know as a favourable balance of trade. Obviously, this solution might be available to some nations, but only on the basis that it makes the situation worse for other nations. If one nation is able to sell more than it buys, then the rest of the world must have bought more than it sold. Therefore, their situation collectively is worse. This struggle to achieve a larger market because one's own people are not sufficiently paid to be able to purchase their own production leads to a great deal of commercial rivalry, envy, and in some cases to trade wars. The First World War, for instance, may well have resulted from the growth of national enmities based on the belief that each nation's economic survival depended on forcing others away from the markets for their goods. There are other factors which tend to exacerbate the shortage of purchasing power in the market. Obviously, an increase in savings will do this. Any investment in industry from wage and salary earnings or dividends received will also lessen the amount of purchasing power in the market today, while of course adding to tomorrow's B payments being charged into prices. Thus far, nobody in authority has been both able to understand what is needed to stop the problem and at the same time had sufficient support from his fellows to do it. Wide support is essential to overcome the counter-pressure from those who benefit from their acquisition of the increasing indebtedness of all nations. The efforts by every nation in the world to export more than they import is an admission that this recurring imbalance in their markets takes place. All nations, even the very richest, such as Japan, the United States, and West Germany, are increasingly adding to their enormous superstructure of debt. This debt tends to allow today's costs to be met by adding at a compound rate to tomorrow's costs. Similarly, all nations are obsessed with their need to sell their assets to foreigners. They are selling their industries, their farming lands, and other assets. This is another admission that the greatest deficiency in their economies is effective purchasing power for consumers. By selling the farm to foreigners, one has increased purchasing power in the community to the extent of its capital value, but there is no extra production in the marketplace. Every government encourages expansion of factories and other capital construction up to, and usually considerably beyond, the consumer's ability to pay for the resulting goods. The one thing holding back industry is the experience of being surrounded by goods whose production has been paid for, but whose market is slow. Industry tends to be rather reluctant and prudent in view of these painful memories. While it is not quite as simple as Chart 5 indicates, it is a useful tool through which to think of the problem. Today's purchasing power is approximately equal to the payments for today's efforts. Today's prices are approximately equal to the payments for today's efforts, plus the payments for yesterday's efforts. What does this really mean? Historic debt, which is counted into today's price, is, in real terms, positive rather than negative. Yesterday's efforts and achievements in constructing capital goods make up our industrial heritage. This is responsible for the ever-increasing abundance of production and the ease with which it is produced. Communities account their historical heritage as a cost which they are entitled to recoup, at least to the degree that it depreciates. The procedure, however, has accounted our industrial inheritance into an historic debt. There is only one thing that can cancel a debt, and that is a credit. Until credits are made available on the basis of our industrial inheritance, sufficient to enable the full liquidation of our historical costs, then there can be no long-term solution to the inadequacy of purchasing power in the marketplace. No solutions, except increased debt, are currently available. Therefore, it is inevitable that increased costs are going to bring continuing inflation. The resulting social costs will bring great pressures on families, increasing taxes, inflation, high interest rates. Pressure mounts on all groups to break the social contract, to lay aside good faith in order to gain short-term advantage. Most of us don't want to become too involved with the technicalities of the question. It is easier to relate to the hypothetical technological society which we discussed at the opening of this segment. In that rather futuristic type example, very considerable historic costs had to be liquidated. However, such technology was so advanced that it paid almost no wages or salaries. In view of its historic, no dividends were paid, at least initially. Thus we had a situation arise where there was superabundant production for everybody, but an inability to distribute that production. Purchasing power was not distributed at the time of production at a rate sufficient to liquidate the historical costs of the new technology, and therefore an horrific disequilibrium was inevitable. Plant that could deliver 20 times more than we consume would cause enormous deprivation if it was not accompanied by sufficient employment, because there would be no funds to pay for our accumulated debt or the items produced. Put another way, yesterday's incomes have already been expended in paying for yesterday's consumer goods. They are no longer available to assist in paying for historical costs which come due today. However, today's prices include today's incomes plus much of yesterday's. the reason why the payment of a national dividend is possible and why the democratisation of money is inevitable is that the West has an enormous industrial inheritance. The West also has an inescapable need to liquidate our historical costs with credit or money distributed as a gift to every citizen. I would like to conclude with a brief reminder of the proposals from the segment on democratising money in order to reinforce it. Firstly, we ask the question as to how much the money supply should be expanded. This ought not to be left in the hands of the banking system or even in the hands of the legislative branch of the government. Our suggestion is that a court be established for the purpose of making quarterly decisions as to what the money supply level ought to be. Such a court must always meet in open session and be able to solicit and receive evidence from any quarter it chooses. It must be open to the submission of evidence from any sector of the community and would have to give full and written decisions accompanied by an account of the factors which influenced the court's thinking and occasioned the final disposition. The legislative branch of the government, as opposed to the judiciary, would be limited to being able to make submissions to the court on the government's behalf. Whether any such submission was relevant or worthy of notice would be entirely a decision for this independent court's judges. The appointment of such judges might follow the procedures for appointment of other judges in that particular nation. However, in this matter, it is most important that the right of the citizenry to recall any judge of this court ought to be established. The establishment of such a court, its proper funding from public funds, the procedures for the appointment of its judges, and the right of the public through citizens-initiated referenda to recall any such judges need to be established in the national constitution in order to lock in the democratisation of money for future generations. The court would need to be empowered to direct the central or reserve bank to create any additional funds deemed needed. This court would also try any complaint against the bank for incorrect dispersal on the basis that every citizen is to receive an equal share and the share due any dependents. This power to direct the central banking authority ought also to be entrenched in that nation's constitution. Entrenchment means that it cannot be changed without the consent of the people at a referendum. The issue of credit or money by any bank apart from the quarterly directive by the court to the Reserve Bank would constitute an offence. The penalties for non-compliance may include the withdrawal of that bank's charter to continue business and the imposition of fines up to the full asset value of the bank. Non-compliance must not be countenanced. In other words, all additions to the money supply shall be prohibited except those that are adjudged to be necessary by the appropriate court of law. New money should be dispersed to the citizenry. It is theoretically possible in a period of some natural disaster that some contraction of the money supply might be necessary. Once a great measure of the historical debt in a nation has been liquidated, the need for anything beyond small increases in the money supply might only arise in unusual circumstances. Normally, even if there were a just case for the contraction of the money supply, it might be adjudged best to decree no increase and to maintain this position until the money unit had re-established something approximate to its initial value, as measured against the nation's price level. If the court did not feel that it could avoid a contraction in the money supply, then it would also need to be constitutionally empowered to direct the legislative branch of government to pay to the Reserve Bank an amount of money equal to the contraction in the money supply needed. This would bring about the contraction of the money supply by forcing the government to impose some form of taxation in order to meet this demand. The head of state, whether in a monarchical system or in a republic like the United States, would then be empowered to dismiss any government that failed to comply with the court's decision, or alternatively to put the matter to the people by referendum for resolution. This, of course, is a most unlikely hypothetical situation unless some great natural disaster or inherent moral breakdown in a society was to destroy productive capacity. It must be understood that the mechanism discussed is simply a mechanism. It has been put forward merely to demonstrate that the traditional approach to such decision-making in Western democracies is remote from the beneficiaries of those decisions. In the event that a community is incapable of attaining the level of moral and intellectual resources with which people respect, cherish, grow, and defend their societies, then there is no hope of anything but chaos for such an association, no matter what its laws. The tragedy is that there already exist in a great part of the world sophisticated and informed communities committed to a future beyond destructive short-term motives. They have simply been denied the knowledge and the possibility of this level of economic enfranchisement for human freedom. In the end, as always, faith shall rule. No nation with inadequate faith in itself and in its fellows will ever achieve the democratisation of money. No nation which loses the social cement of the good faith of its citizens can hope to retain its freedoms. We will certainly never win new freedoms which we are unable to understand, nor retain those we cannot or will not defend. The results of an enterprise are determined by the qualities we bring to its service. Only trust, duty, and responsibility, working through service, will bring perfect freedom into our social environment.